This is my zine. I'm going to read an article from a Canadian magazine called Equinox. It's about salmon trees. You probably have never heard of salmon trees, but this article will show you that there's a relationship between salmon and trees. If you're not a hunter or a fisher, but if you are an environmentalist, perhaps you suspect there's some relationship between different species out there in nature. But you may not know exactly what it is. In fact, hunters and fishers have not known a lot of the specific connections that you'll hear in this article, so I hope it's interesting. This is written by Nancy Barron. Our 65-foot motor vessel, Blue Fjord, is anchored in Barnard Inlet. The night is cold and wet as we wriggle into hip waders and rain gear and strap on bear spray-laden belts. Then we load cameras, tripods, and umbrellas into the Red Zodiac, tied to our floating home, and head out into the rain for the fourth time since this morning. Encrusted with mud from days of slogging up and down streams and bushwhacking through rainforest, our ragged-looking crew of six is still eager for the chase. We are trailing researcher Tom Reimchen as he journeys up the northern coast of British Columbia to investigate 55 watersheds for evidence to support his revolutionary discovery about the workings of West Coast ecosystems. As the Zodiac cuts across the clear waters of the inlet, Dan Klinka, Reimchen's field assistant, whispers to me, "Tom is the most passionate and driven man I've ever met." Klinka is no slouch himself. Hardworking and unflappable, he is perfectly suited for working with Reimchen, and for researching bears at night. Reimchen's graduate student, Deanna Mathewson, is equally diligent. Tiny as a gymnast, she is as tough as anyone else on the team. Earlier, we had seen swarms of salmon in the estuary, which means that after dark, the place should be crawling with bears. We clutch night vision monoculars and infrared flashlights, our windows into a hidden world. Over the years of his study, Reimchen has observed that bears fishing for salmon are almost twice as successful at night as during daylight hours, which is why we are heading out now. The moment the Zodiac pulls away from the lights of the boat, we can see part of the reason why bears have such good luck at night. The wake off the Zodiac's bow splashes green, and the water churned by the engine leaves a contrail of light. Each drop of rain that hits the water sparkles like a twinkling star. This astonishing display of phosphorescence is caused by a type of plankton called noctiluca, meaning night lights. Any agitation triggers a burst of chemical light from these tiny critters, making the ocean look like a liquid galaxy. Myriad little fishes light up as they flee the boat like thousands of shooting stars going off in every direction. Near the river's mouth, we startle an army of salmon. Meter-long chum shoot away like comets, leaving behind a long, luminous trail, each burst of light a physical sensation. We drop to our hands and knees to gaze over the sides of the Zodiac. None of us have ever seen such a spectacle, fish scribbling the water with light. "Aquatic fireworks," murmurs Reimchen. "Salmon," he tells us, "avoid moving, unless a boat passes over them like this, because they light up like lamps when they move, making them easy targets for the bears. Bioluminescence is common in late summer and fall, coinciding with the salmon's return to spawn." Reimchen speculates that salmon have adapted to this problem by going into a nocturnal torpor, out of which they aren't readily roused. As we step out of the boat and wade into the river's mouth, the salmon lie like floating logs in the water. When our boots bump up against them, they don't respond. Following the creek, we enter forest as black as a bear's coat. We peer through night vision glasses. It's like peeking through a keyhole into a spooky, green, glowing world. Wherever we shine our infrared lights, we pick up bear eyeshine, two gleaming emeralds in a dark pool. There is bear activity all around us, but we can see only a tiny bit at a time. The bears shuffle up and down along the creek on trails worn by generations. to establish who is around and how close, they mark trees with scent. Bears are visually sensitive to each other, but at night they seem less leery and fish side by side. One balances on a log in the creek's center. We watch in silence as it gropes in the water, grabs a salmon, and retreats into the forest to eat. We can't see it, but we can hear it, and we wince at the double pop of its teeth biting into the fish's brain. Brains are best, Ramchen says. Testes are detested. Tonight the bears are biting off the heads and leaving the bodies, scattering them everywhere. But when salmon are scarce, the bears can't afford to be so picky. In other areas, we've seen entire fish devoured, only the long, earring-like testes left uneaten. Bristol Foster, Ramchen's longtime friend, who is along to video the bear's behavior, jokingly suggests that we drape ourselves in testes as bear-proofing. Ramchen replies that bears can strip the knackers out of salmon with surgical precision, so it wouldn't do as much good. Tonight, chum salmon are so plentiful that the bears are being very fussy. Time after time, we watch one bear catch a fish in its mouth, and seconds later, spit it out and try again. When fishing is this good, the bears select for females. If they catch a male, they immediately sense its sex by smell, release it, and try again. Ramchen has found that the captured females are often already spawned out, so the bear's impact on salmon reproduction is minimal. Klinka is having trouble with his infrared beam and clicks it on and off repeatedly. The bear stops fishing and stares in our direction. Ramchen hisses at Klinka to stop. Silence. The bear turns away and resumes fishing. We exhale deeply, relieved. The bear is absorbed in its work, feasting in preparation for winter hibernation. Salmon and bears are doing well this year at Barnard Inlet. When we finally get back to the boat, an elated Ramchen stays up much of the night celebrating the spectacle of plenty. In the quiet wilderness of Haida Gwaii, formerly called the Queen Charlotte Islands, Sitka spruce and western hemlocks form a green curtain above the crisp cut of the high tide line. Dusty green lichens hang like strands of wool from an insert of alders, a telltale sign that a freshwater stream weaves through the forest to the sea. In 1992, as Ramchen mused on the problem of how to measure the importance of salmon to species other than humans, he wandered up this stream. Crawling over and under barricades of blowdowns, he noticed that on the plush, moss-covered backs of the fallen giants were littered hundreds of snaggle-toothed jaws, spiky ribs, and clear cartilaginous medallions, the circular gill covers of salmon. They extended up to 150 meters into the forest. What, he wondered, was responsible for carrying all these fish back into the forest? Otters? Eagles? Martens? Setting up his tent near the estuary, he sat in the forest, watching and waiting. For days he saw nothing. Then, late one night, as he lay in his tent, he heard splashing. Creeping outside, he could make out the inky shapes of several black bears working the stream. He was astonished, because by day he had never seen more than one bear at a time. All night, the bears moved back and forth from stream to forest, finally fading away at first light. Following the biorhythm of the bears, he began staying up all night and sleeping by day. He determined that under cover of darkness, six bears were working the stream for the biblical 40 days and 40 nights of the salmon run. As he watched them methodically hauling fish after fish into the deep bush, he conceived a whole new understanding of the flow of life between the land and the sea. The impact of the salmon-bear connection, Ramchen now knew, surges far beyond the stream side. In Bag Harbor, he found that bears took 80% of the entire salmon run into the forest. When the young salmon leave the natal river, they roam the Pacific, feeding and growing until they return to spawn. Then, with the bear's help, they contribute their maritime harvest to the forest in the form of their flesh. During the 40-day spawning period, he calculated, each bear ferries about 700 salmon, amounting to 1,600 kilograms of fertilizer, far into the woods. Under conditions of abundance, the bears eat less than half of their haul. By Reimchen's reckoning, this one small stream provided enough salmon for 2 martens, 4 eagles, 12 ravens, 150 glaucous-winged gulls, and 250 crows. When these animals dispersed through the forest, massive recycling continued as they spread nitrogen through their droppings. Decaying salmon also kick-start a maggot population that emerges in spring to feed warblers and flycatchers that arrive famished after their long journey north. And the nutrient-seeking trees take up whatever is left over. In fact, up to 50% of the total nitrogen the trees use comes from salmon. It's a give-and-take relationship. The salmon fertilize the trees with their bodies at the end of their lives, and the fallen giants provide backwater nurseries for more young salmon. As the trees decompose, their nitrogen is released into the stream, feeding tiny plants and insects that nourish new generations of fish. Thinking beyond Haida Gwaii to the coast-wide decline of wild salmon, Reimchen reasons that while we worry about the loss of forests and the impact on salmon, the reverse is also a concern. Salmon not only need forests, but forests also need salmon. As he pondered the significance of this interdependency, he made an important creative leap. The ambient air is about 80% nitrogen-14, but salmon tissue contains elevated levels of a special ocean-originated isotope called nitrogen-15. Therefore, by sampling the tree's annual growth rings and measuring the relative presence of nitrogen-15 through time, he could reconstruct a picture of the historic abundance of salmon and show precisely when they disappeared from and returned to a system. To test his theory, he augured cores through the annual rings from trees in Bag Harbor, then sent them to a university in California where a sensitive mass spectrometer analyzed the presence of nitrogen-15. We got our data from Bag Harbor back, and bingo, there it was, the long-term picture of nitrogen-15 and therefore of salmon in the forest. But the results were puzzling. In Bag Harbor, the nitrogen-15 isotope was virtually nothing, then started to rise radically right after 1900. The question was, why? One possible explanation came from Guja, a Haida leader who told Reimchen that the Haida had used Bag Harbor until the late 1800s. After that time, because of smallpox and other problems brought on by white settlers, the Haida moved north. After the Haida left, says Reimchen, perhaps bears came back and resumed fishing for salmon. Bears and Haida don't coexist on the same streams. Reimchen realized that the salmon signature could be a unique window on the past abundance of salmon, and he resolved to test other watersheds in British Columbia to see what their salmon signatures revealed. Finally accepting that this was too big a task to tackle alone, he moved to Victoria, took a teaching position at the university, and brought on a graduate student, Deanna Mathewson, and field assistants like Klinka. He also went to Forest Renewal British Columbia for help, but was told that his research had, quote, nothing to do with forestry, unquote. Then the Suzuki Foundation heard about his discovery of the salmon signature and recognized its potential as leverage to change policy on how close logging can come to stream sides. The foundation offered support. The British Columbia Forest Practices Code has no exact definition of riparian forest, simply stating that the area along streams must be protected from logging. The width of that strip, however, is controversial, and logging companies are constantly trying to whittle it away. Whereas in Washington State, riparian is defined as a mere 66 feet, Reimchen's work demonstrates a new functional and philosophical definition of riparian forest that extends far beyond a narrow band, bringing new meaning to author Timothy Egan's definition of the Pacific Northwest as anywhere a salmon can get to. And that, Reimchen reasoned, could be defined by the salmon's signature. Out of the many hundreds and hundreds of watersheds we could examine, we needed to prioritize them, says Reimchen. Working with the Suzuki Foundation, he ranked the watersheds of the middle and north coasts of British Columbia. First, Reimchen and his co-workers looked at Department of Fisheries and Oceans, or DFO, data going back to 1947. It was a nightmare to get the data on salmon streams from DFO, says Reimchen. They wanted a full-scale proposal to see how we were going to use the data, which is public information. DFO maintained that the data were not reliable, but Reimchen suspects that part of the reason they balked was because the news was not good. Although the salmon cycles fluctuate from year to year, in general, according to DFO's own data, salmon returns have decreased 85% since 1947. Next, they approached the Provincial Ministry of Environment to examine its data about which watersheds had bear activity. Then they overlaid this on the data pertaining to salmon streams, and, big surprise, says Reimchen, the watersheds with high grizzly values corresponded with the highest value salmon streams. Finally, they cross-referenced those with the sites most immediately threatened by logging. This formed the logic for the choice of the 55 watersheds that Reimchen was examining on this expedition up the coast with Klinka, Mathewson, and Foster as his assistants, coring trees, collecting plant samples, studying bear and salmon interactions, and filming their activities. The article goes on. I'm going to skip most of the rest of it and just read from the last two paragraphs. The requirements that bears have, the fact that 70% of their yearly consumption of protein has to come from salmon, enters no fishery policy. The timing is critical, since the bears need the energy to tide them over their winter hibernation, and they have no fallback systems. And as Reimchen now knows, the other users are not just the bears, but also the ravens, the gulls, and the martens, as well as a multitude of marine and insect life. Even the trees and the songbirds that nest in them rely on the salmon. Reimchen is adamant that a lot of things have to change if we want to save not only the salmon, but all the other lives that depend on them. Now that the irrefutable evidence is in, he wants to see action by the bureaucrats. He says we must start factoring the needs of other species into our fisheries allocations, for when the salmon fail to show, the whole forest is in terrible trouble. This article was called Salmon Trees. It was written by Nancy Barron, a science journalist specializing in marine issues, and it was published in Equinox, a Canadian magazine, in the April-May issue of 2000. Here's something that seems like a really good idea, a chemical-free weed killer. Highway departments all over the country use pesticides to kill weeds along roadsides. Railroads do too, and sometimes other owners of public land, school districts, will use poisons to kill weeds. Now a New Zealand company has built a weed-killing machine that uses super hot water instead of chemicals. The technology, already in use in other countries, is virtually unknown in the U.S. One city, Carrboro, North Carolina, began using their machine in 1999. The machine is mounted on a small truck. Teams walking alongside use hoses with long-handled applicator wands to quickly spray and scald weeds. The plants darken almost immediately and turn brown within a few hours. The hot water destroys the weeds by melting the protective waxy coating on the leaves. For more information about this, two contacts, Pesticide Action Network of North America. Their website is www.panna.org, and the Agricultural Resources Center, 115 West Main, Carrboro, that's Carrboro, North Carolina, 27510. Here's another good idea. From Burlington, Washington, an article in the Oregonian titled Migrant Housing Shelters Skagit County's Homeless. The houses sat empty from September through June, waiting for the migrant farm workers who come every summer. Meanwhile, people such as Christina Arnold and her four children slept on floors and stayed in cheap motels, searching desperately for a home. Then Maley Akoba of Skagit County Community Action had a brainstorm. Why not let homeless families live in the migrant worker housing for 9 months of the year? Thus was born an innovative housing solution in Skagit County that has benefits for the county, the homeless families, the farmers who rent out the houses, and even the migrant workers who return in the summer. We live in different worlds, but the possibilities began to come together, said Mike Youngquist, a fruit and vegetable farmer who's leasing 5 mobile homes to the homeless program. Arnold's family was among 13 families who moved into the mobile homes and apartments last week. They'll pay rent at about a third of the market rate, receive counseling and support services, and learn skills they need to get a job and stay afloat. Arnold said the move has given her hope for the first time in months. She became homeless after her husband stopped paying child support. She lost her job, and she was evicted from her apartment. Since then, she and her kids have moved at least 7 times. They get to finish a whole year in the same school, Arnold said as she moved into her new home. State officials are watching the Skagit County program with interest, although they say it may not translate to other areas. Many farms in Skagit County are on the edge of urban centers, making them convenient for homeless families. Elsewhere, farms and migrant housing are in more isolated rural areas. If you follow the discussion about destroying or bypassing dams that are in the way of migrating salmon, you may know that there was a dam on the Kennebec River in Maine, which was actually removed not too long ago, the first such action. Here's a report on what happened afterwards. This is from the Earth First Journal in 2000. It says, salmon and bass surge after dam is demolished. Atlantic salmon have returned to the waters of Maine's Kennebec River above the site of a 162-year-old dam that was recently torn down to allow the fish to swim upstream. Striped bass have also returned in very large numbers. The stripers have been feeding on alewives that have also swum upstream from the Atlantic. The removal of the 24-foot-high Edwards Dam was ordered in 1997 by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for the good of the environment. The dam was about 40 miles from the Atlantic, 917 feet long, and blocked salmon, shad, herring, and other fish from swimming to their spawning grounds. The Kennebec River has also been cleaned up significantly. Here's a couple of other good ideas, at least in my opinion. An example of how community-issued money can be used for the public good is told by Alexander Kim, organizer of Mo Money in Louisiana. In Ireland, around the middle of the century, villagers wanted to erect a common indoor market center. However, they did not want to issue a municipal bond because of the interest they would have to pay over the years and because of the potential lack of large investors. The community leaders decided to issue coupons, which were essentially a local currency that depicted the name of the town and the marketplace. By selling these notes, the town raised enough money to pay for the building. After the building was completed, the residents of the community could spend the coupons with any of the merchants in the market center. The merchants, in turn, were allowed to use those same coupons to pay their rent at the market. Eventually, all the coupons were redeemed. The town did not have to pay interest on the capital. In the end, the community enjoyed a powerful sense of ownership of the public market. And yet one more idea. Community money can be put to work for many uses, including public works. The government of Curitiba, Brazil, for example, has been issuing bus tokens to residents in its poorest districts in exchange for recyclable garbage. Developed in the 1980s by Jaime Lerner, the city's mayor at the time, the bus token program not only keeps the city clean at a low cost, but also helps residents gain access to jobs and business opportunities beyond walking distance from their homes. The program pays for itself through the sale of the recyclable garbage to large recycling firms. Here's an idea. It comes from Anonymous, and all I have is an artist rendering. What it is a view of high-tension power towers going across the landscape. You've seen those. There are thousands and thousands of them across the country. And obviously, they're an integral part of our electric grid. But on top of these, the artist has put windmills, wind generators. Not the huge ones that they're making now with blades that are 100 feet long, but the old-fashioned smaller ones that you might see on an old farmstead. It's windy on top of these power towers, and the modern wind generators don't need much of a wind to get them moving. If every one of these power towers had a wind generator added at the top of it, I wonder how much electricity would be produced without using any more land, very little wire from the top of the tower down, not too much in the way of materials. It might be a really good idea. Wayne Township in Pennsylvania, Mifflin County, Pennsylvania, enacted a law in 1998 by a 3-0 vote. It is also a similar one has also passed in nearby Thompson Township. It prohibits any corporation from doing business in the township if it has a history of consistently violating environmental, health, or labor laws. Corporations are banned from doing business in the township if any of its current directors sit on other corporate boards that consistently violate regulatory law. If you'd like to know more about this ordinance, here's a contact. Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF. Their website is www.celdf.org, and a phone number, 717-530-0931. I've been following alternative technology for a long time, in particular, solar technologies. Here's something that's new within the last couple of years, which seems to have a lot of potential. I'm reading from the summer 2001 edition of Whole Earth Review. Imagine urban buildings that harvest sunlight. Their walls are photovoltaic, directly converting sunlight into electrical power using solid-state semiconductor wafers or thin films mounted on panels. There is no fuel consumed, no sound, no maintenance, no moving parts, and no pollution of any kind. And it makes money. Most photovoltaic systems are mounted on racks or on poles. A skyscraper is a giant rack. These vast power-generating surfaces can supply everyone within the building and, at midday, can export power throughout the city. No need to store any power. The city's utility grid still supplies power at night and during clouds and rain. The Enlightened Power Company pays the building owner for the juice supplied to the grid. Not only would this work financially and physically, the buildings themselves would look great. Using solar panels as a structural component is known as Building Integrated Photovoltaics, or BIPV. Solar panels replace conventional walls or roof cladding. Labor that might have been wasted on a conventional roof simply mounts the electrical skin instead. Installing solar from the get-go saves on real estate and site development costs. The utility wires the building, so there's no need for new interconnections. Best of all, it's hard to imagine any more visible and public commitment to sustainability than the roof, walls, and awnings of a major league urban skyscraper. Solar architect Stephen Strong pioneered this concept in his 1980 solar home design for a client in Carlisle, Massachusetts. In the 1990s, BIPV began to take off in Europe and Japan. Dozens of photovoltaic-clad buildings were constructed in Switzerland and Germany. Recently, 15 exemplary photovoltaic integrated buildings were documented by architects Gregory Kiss and Dr. Petrina Eifert. Austin Energy in Austin, Texas, will furnish the PV materials for a gigantic sunscreen for the city's new convention center expansion, now under construction. The power-producing sunscreen will filter sunlight on the western wall, daylighting the lobby and lowering power bills at the same time. They're also putting up solar sunshades over city parking lots throughout town. A private group of investors in Austin will clad the new world-class performing arts center in PV roofing and facade, turning the center into a small generator between performances. The solar industry now offers quite a variety of solar products integrated into buildings. Electricity-producing glass panels. These substitute for curtain wall spandrels, the opaque glass, between rows of windows. Encapsulated wafer-type solar cells. These wafers are sandwiched between layers of glass and spaced out to allow light transmission between the cells. These panels create a beautiful pattern of diffuse light during daylighting. PV roofing systems specifically designed for flat roofs. And rigid roofing tiles and flexible shingles, PV panels compatible with metal roofing and awnings. Photovoltaic panels don't come cheap, but almost every major building budgets something for sheer character. Imported granite or polished marble goes for about the same price as photovoltaic building skin. The difference? A solar skin has a cash flow stream. A marble facade can deliver only prestige, as the soot and acid rain of a fossil-fueled city slowly eat it away. So this article was in Whole Earth Review in summer 2001. It was written by Mark Kapner of Austin, Texas. To learn more about the City of Austin's Green Building Program, a website is www.greenbuilder, that's all one word, greenbuilder.com/sourcebook. So I hope that's clear. The surface area of the outside of a skyscraper or any similar vertical urban building, between the windows, the builder is paying for some kind of surface, granite or metal or plastic or something. And as long as you're paying for something, why not have it be photovoltaic electricity producing panels? Also, windows are now made, double windows are now made with solar cells between the panes of glass. It lets enough light through to brighten the building inside and also produces electricity. Here's a new kind of automobile. A Frenchman, Guy Negre, claims to have invented a non-polluting car. The Evolution, that's little e dot capital V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N, evolution, doesn't burn air, it runs on air. Compressed air, pumped into the 1,542-pound vehicle's tanks, is slowly released to power pistons that drive the car. Filling the tanks at home takes 4 hours. A fill-up at an air station takes 3 minutes. A fully pumped Evolution can travel 120 miles for a mere 30 cents. Air fuel is completely recyclable, and the car's only tailpipe emission is air. The Evolution debuted at the Auto Africa Expo in Johannesburg last October. Priced at $10,000, the Air car is already rolling off production lines in France. 3 Air car factories are being built in Australia, and 3 more plants are under construction in South Africa, Mexico, and Spain. The aim of the project is to cut costs and create jobs locally, serving the consumer market directly, according to Zero Pollution Motors chief Helen Brown. It's really an anti-globalization production idea. One caveat: if the electricity to compress the air is produced by a coal-powered plant, the Evolution is just another devolution. That electricity doesn't have to be produced in a coal-powered plant. You may know that in the United States, corporations are considered persons for legal means. This is the result, actually a byproduct, of a Supreme Court decision in 1886, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific. It wasn't even the main point of the ruling, but since then it has been taken nationwide that a corporation is a person. However, the town of Point Arena in California's North Coast has passed a resolution ending corporate personhood privileges within city limits. Dave Hansen, director of California's Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, views the decades-long string of environmental crises as symptoms of a much greater problem, that of undemocratic, illegitimate corporate power turning economic and resource decisions into private property market decisions. He cheers the Point Arena activists, saying that they are on the right track when they focus on dismantling the legal fiction of corporate personhood. They are uncovering the foundation of corporate authority that has allowed it to destroy the environment with the legal protection of the Constitution. Here's the ordinance, it's just one sentence. Corporations are artificial entities separate from natural persons, not naturally endowed with consciousness or with the rights of natural persons. That's City of Point Arena, Resolution number 2000-07. For more information about this, you can contact the Redwood Coast Alliance for Democracy, Post Office Box 1581, Gualala, spelled G-U-A-L-A-L-A, California, 95445. Here's an article from the Oregonian, October 10th, 1999. It's titled, Episcopalian Priest Has Beef with Big Chicken Industry. This is written by Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times News Service. The dateline is Georgetown, Delaware. It was an incongruous sight, the white-haired priest in black shirt and white collar, standing in an immense poultry house filled with thousands of clucking birds and the acrid stench of manure. The priest, the Reverend Jim Lewis, was in this unlikely place because the Episcopal Church has assigned him an unlikely mission: to improve the lives of Delaware's chicken farmers and poultry plant workers. Lewis says his work is akin to that of the Old Testament prophets who railed against injustices, but the state's powerful poultry industry describes him as a one-man plague. Day after day, as he muddles his feet in manure, meeting with embittered farmers and poultry workers, Lewis harbors no doubt that he is doing the Lord's work in confronting an industry he calls Big Chicken. My big beef with Big Chicken is it's a greedy industry, said Lewis, who is based in Georgetown, a southern Delaware town at the hub of the region's poultry industry. Greed is a good old-fashioned spiritual concern. But industry officials often accuse Lewis of being deaf to their side of the story. Bill Satterfield, executive director of the Delmarva Poultry Industry Association, said, "The church certainly has a role in improving the quality of life, but they're not the only ones who have concerns about the quality of life." He called Lewis's attacks inflammatory and often inaccurate. "The industry is providing employment to thousands of people and is helping feed the world with a safe product," he said. "I don't understand what he means when he says we're a greedy industry. Our industry pays a competitive wage. They hire people who otherwise would be unemployed. Many Hispanic workers come to this area because of the opportunities this industry has provided." The hard-driving clergyman, a former Marine and former All-State football player, has preached against the industry's ways, skewering it for driving too hard a bargain with chicken farmers and workers who spend hour after hour hacking away at chicken parts in cold, damp plants. Through his unusual ministry, Lewis has earned a reputation among religious leaders as a leading practitioner of a growing trend in which hundreds of U.S. priests, ministers, and rabbis are using their pulpits and moral stature to fight for workers, especially those on the bottom rungs. Often his ministry seems equal parts caring and daring. He has formed an unusual multiracial alliance of plant workers, farmers, and environmentalists to stand up to the industry. He once angered union, industry, and church leaders by helping lead a wildcat strike against a poultry plant where a worker was fired after he had cut a finger off. He has condemned poultry companies for not providing health insurance to chicken catchers who have the dangerous job of cramming thousands of chickens into cages each day before they are shipped to slaughter. He organized a one-day visit by 5 members of Congress who heard workers complain of injuries from chopping chickens all day long and of wages so low that they qualified for welfare. Lewis's coalition, the Delmarva Poultry Justice Alliance, has become one of the most powerful voices in one of the nation's leading poultry areas, the Delmarva Peninsula, in eastern Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, which produces 3 billion pounds of chicken each year, thanks to the peninsula's 2,700 chicken farms, 11 poultry processing plants, and 15,000 poultry workers. When Lewis stopped in at Carol Morrison's farm in Pocomoke City, Maryland, while doing his alliance building, she gave him an earful about the poultry corporations. "The industry exploits her by not paying enough for her chickens," she said. She complained that her family farm has lost money the past 2 years after she and her husband invested $220,000 to build 2 500-foot-long chicken houses a decade ago. To make ends meet, her husband has had to take a full-time job with a farm equipment dealer. Purdue periodically gives her 54,000 chicks a day old. Then for 7 weeks, she raises them to be 5-pound broilers. Purdue pays her 16 cents a bird, after subtracting the cost of Purdue-supplied chicken feed and medicine. Morrison, who lives with her husband and son in a $20,000 trailer, said Purdue also required her to spend $30,000 on a metal manure shed to reduce the runoff of manure into nearby streams. Lewis first showed up at the Morrison's door in 1995, soon after the Episcopal Bishop of Delaware hired him. That bishop, Cable Tennis, now retired, said he wanted Lewis to help those working in the chicken industry to go beyond giving care and charity and to work to change social structures in a way that would help eliminate poverty. That's by Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times, published in the Oregonian, October 10, 1999. The chicken industry has really been consolidated. Just 2 or 3 companies control most of the chicken that is bought and eaten in this country. whether at home or in restaurants. The farmers are basically contractors with restrictions that written into contracts that are developed by very good lawyers for very large corporations. The workers, as you heard, get paid very little, and the work is hard and dangerous and usually cold and dirty. I read a short piece earlier about what finally happened with the salmon when a dam was torn down on a stream in Maine. Here's another similar approach. This is about what happened in Salt Lake City after a gay students' club was banned from meeting after school in the school building. Almost 3 years after the school board banned extracurricular clubs to get rid of a gay students' group, the target of the ban is thriving, and East High School, where Gay Straight Alliance so unsettled officials, is hurting. Dozens of clubs disbanded, including Students Against Drunk Driving, the Crazy E Pep Club, Young Republicans, Young Democrats, and several that promoted ethnic awareness, as well as groups that celebrated Bart Simpson, UFOs, and the joys of eating beef. School spirit has evaporated, students socialize less, and class and racial rifts are deeper than before, say students and teachers. People don't care about school anymore, said cheerleader Chris Trindell. It's been a disaster, said Scott Nelson, a social studies and history teacher. There's more to education than just the curriculum. There's a certain social element. The turmoil began in 1995 with a student request for school sanction of a support group for homosexual teens, the Gay Straight Alliance. The Utah State Legislature quickly lined up in opposition and began a contentious period of hearings that culminated in spring 1996 with passage of a bill banning school clubs that encourage criminal or delinquent conduct, bigotry, or sexual behavior. The bill was eventually incorporated into State Board of Education rules approved the following winter. But the Salt Lake School Board wasn't waiting for state guidance. Advised that federal law prohibits schools from discriminating against clubs on the basis of unpopular ideas they espouse, but unwilling to stomach the Gay Straight Alliance, the board in February 1996 banished all clubs not linked to academic studies in the city's four high schools. The Gay Straight Alliance survived because it had the guidance and support of the politically savvy Gay Lesbian Straight Education Network, a national gay rights group. Now, under sponsorship of the network, the Alliance meets as a community group and pays $6 an hour to rent an East High classroom one afternoon a week. Other clubs died for lack of adult volunteers and the money to pay rent and insurance premiums. The few groups still allowed, science, math, and language clubs, along with athletic, debate, and drama teams, attract mostly college-bound students. According to science teacher Camille Lee, the students hurt the most are those with tenuous after-school links to school. So that was in the Oregonian in December 1998, written by Kristen Moulton of the Associated Press. If you're interested in militarism and in the environment, I want to recommend a book to you. It's called Weapons Incorporated, written by William Thompson. I'll read just a few very brief quotes. War making is the world's biggest business. The U.S. military is itself a major multinational corporation with assets equal to half of all U.S. manufacturing companies combined. Nearly 40% of U.S. industrial plants and equipment are devoted to military manufacturing. In 1989, approximately 30% of all U.S. industrial output was purchased by the Pentagon. And again, the U.S. military is not only the biggest single source of environmental pollution in the country, it is also the biggest environmental outlaw. Of 383 EPA citations issued to federal facilities in 1989, nearly three-quarters went to military installations. Today's armed forces are responsible for 10 to 30% of global environmental damage, 6 to 10% of worldwide air pollution, and 20% of all ozone-destroying chlorofluorocarbon use. The Government Accounting Office reports that the U.S. Department of Defense currently generates 500,000 tons of toxic waste annually, more than the top five chemical companies combined. And one more. The Pentagon is the single largest energy user domestically and very likely worldwide. In 12 months, it uses enough energy to run the entire U.S. urban mass transit system for 22 years. These quotes are from Weapons Incorporated, the world's biggest militias, by William Thompson. And they were reproduced in the summer 1995 edition of Earth Island Journal. Let's continue with the cost of militarism. This is an article from Matthew Wald of the New York Times, reproduced in the Oregonian. The United States has spent far more on nuclear weapons than it has acknowledged, about one-fourth to one-third of the entire military budget since 1945, according to an independent study made public last week. The study's authors reached their conclusion by totaling the costs of research and development, weapons delivery systems, security, communications and control systems, dismantlement costs, and environmental cleanup. The study gives the price tag, translated into $1995 under a Defense Department formula, as $3.9 trillion, an amount roughly equal to the nation's entire output of goods and services for 7 months. One of the study's researchers, John Pike, director of the Space Policy Project at the Federation of American Scientists, said the total was roughly equivalent to all that had been spent on the Army or the Navy since World War II. The Pentagon does not tally all nuclear weapons spending, much of which is included in the budget of the Department of Energy, or its predecessor, the Atomic Energy Commission. The study said the Defense Department does keep a total for a major forces program, the Pentagon's term for strategic nuclear weapons, which comes to about one-fourth of the number calculated by the study. But that tally does not count tactical nuclear bombs and other nuclear weapons, research and development, and other costs. At the Energy Department, a top official recognized many of the numbers in the study as ones that came directly from that department, such as those dealing with the cost of nuclear warheads, but the official did not have any information on the expenditures for the missiles to deliver the warheads, an area in which the Energy Department has no experience. The study made public last week was produced by the United States Nuclear Weapons Cost Study Project, a private group. It had the collaboration of analysts from various non-governmental groups, including the Brookings Institution, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Defense Budget Project, and the National Security Archive. The study also counted the cost of various dead ends in the military application of nuclear technology. These include a nuclear-powered airplane, $6 billion, a nuclear-powered rocket engine, $2.7 billion, the Midget Man missile, $3.7 billion, and the Safeguard Anti-Ballistic Missile System, $25 billion. It listed $2 billion spent at the Savannah River Nuclear Weapons Plant in South Carolina to prepare reactors for restarting before they were permanently shut, and $1.6 billion spent from 1964 to 1993 to maintain readiness to resume atmospheric weapons testing, which was not done. The study refigured the cost of well-known weapon systems such as the B-52 bomber, often described as a $47 million airplane. When it carries 20 nuclear-tipped cruise missiles or 20 nuclear bombs, the cost of the bomber rises sharply from $267 million to $507 million, the study said. Likewise, a Trident submarine cost $1.7 billion, but with its missiles, the cost becomes about $5.3 billion, according to the study. When the United States began its buildup of nuclear weapons at the height of the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s, the conventional wisdom was that such weapons were a cost-effective alternative to massive armies and navies, said the study's director, Stephen Schwartz, a guest scholar at Brookings. But this wasn't done on the cheap, he said, adding that it only seemed that way because the costs were spread among various budgets with great secrecy and poor congressional oversight. Other authorities on the subject said that although a lot was spent, a lot was accomplished. I'm not sure what the point is, said Dr. Kim Holmes, a vice president of the Heritage Foundation, who specializes in foreign policy and defense studies. If nuclear deterrence worked, and the Clinton administration is going around saying it still does, it's certainly worth one-third of the budget, even if that's what it costs. Holmes said that he had not seen the study, but he found it hard to believe the price tag for the nation's nuclear weapons since 1945 came to $3.9 trillion. That figure includes $15 billion for retiring and dismantling nuclear weapons and delivery systems, and for secure storing or disposal of plutonium and uranium. It also includes $385 billion, most of it not yet spent, for the environmental cleanup of land contaminated with radioactive material from weapons production, a number drawn from the Energy Department. That's about $15,000 per American. And that's from the Oregonian in 1995. Built by the United States, about 8,000.